Wednesday, March 6, 2013. We have three bills on the agenda. We're going to start this afternoon with Senator Bonham, Senate Bill 247, Money Transmitters, Fraud Prevention Measures, and so forth. So, Senator Bonham, if you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. And I'd like to offer two author's amendments. And Mr. Chair, I know that it is your preference to have things worked out before we come here. And so these author's amendments are an attempt to do that to the best of my ability today. So the
it's the A2 amendment? A1 amendment.
Well, the delete first. All is the A1 amendment.
Okay. All right. Why don't you, members have it?
Yep.
Okay, you can proceed to explain the A1 amendment.
And Mr. Chair, wouldn't you rather just get both together so we can do them together?
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. We'll just put them on and then you can present those.
Okay, good.
Senator Ryder moves the A1 amendment.
Okay.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed. Motion prevails. Senator Housley moves the A2 amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like. All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. That's the way to proceed. Go ahead, aye. Senator Bonham.
Thank you very much. So this bill is commonly referred to as the granny scam bill, and we've all heard about this. This is a situation where our loved ones, traditionally our seniors, are taken advantage of in a really vulnerable time in their life. And most often we hear about the grandma who's called by a grandchild who says, you know, grandma, I'm in jail or I've been hurt and, you know, I don't want mom and dad to know. Can you please help me? Can you wire money? And in fact, this isn't the only type of scam. And so what you're going to hear about from testifiers today is some really heartbreaking stories of from people actually who were scammed. So what this bill does is it expands money transmitter fraud prevention. It creates a list of individuals who are not allowed to engage in money transmissions. It limits money transmission ability by countries with high incidence of fraud. We've actually learned that some countries are more apt to be places where these offenders do business than others. It notifies the sender if money is picked up at a location other than that specified, and it actually allows the transmitter, provides an opportunity for the transmitter to give a receipt to the sender with the name of the receiver and the location the money was picked up. So if you go to the actual A1, the beginning, and the original bill, just for your information, was very narrow, and the more we talked about this issue, the more awareness we had that there were things that we could do that weren't part of the original, and so the delete all is the complete version of that. And I do want to thank you to AARP for their efforts. This is their number one priority this year, and they have done a tremendous job of bringing forward this proposal. But so if you begin the no transmit list, this authorizes the commissioner to create and maintain an electronic list of individuals for whom money transmitters may not make money transmissions. Within that, we're giving that authority to the commissioner. And this is a situation where somebody who's been a victim of this, actually it happens more than once. It often happens to the same person 2, 3, and 4 times because the very behavior that had them be susceptible in the first place is continued, and it begins to have a relationship which is a preying on their trust, and it's a very sad situation. So Subdivision 3 goes through all of the ways in which that is enforced. Subdivision 4 has a suspicious activity report where the commissioner can put someone on a suspicious activity report. They're listed. There's the high incidence of schemes to defraud, again, making sure that we know of places where this happens, and then the notification of attempted receipt. As we reviewed the changes with the companies who actually do this, the transmitting of money, they had some concerns, and so the A2 amendment just cleans up some of the ways that we wanted to offer these protections in keeping with their requests. In particular, on page 2, line 29, we wanted to have the location listed to make sure that if the wire is going to a location other than specified, that the sender is notified of that. Well, location was too narrow of a parameter, so they requested that we put state or country other than the state or country specified. To be honest, members, this is the one contentious issue we still have with this bill, because those on the other side also wanted the word city to be included because they felt as though that was not narrow enough. So that is something that will continue to be discussed. Finally, members, we are asking that a sender, when they're there to send their transmission, that they can request information about who actually picked up the wire and where it was picked up. And then you may think, well, if they're being, you know, if they're being a victim of fraud, what would make you think they would even know to ask for that information? So we've also said, or an authorized delegate. So the person who's helping them send the wire transmission, kind of picture, they could check a box that says, we want the sender to get that information back. And none of these solutions are perfect. I mean, the more you delve into this, the more you realize that this is pervasive. It's, you know, it's really evil, and the safeguards that we're putting in place won't make it foolproof, but if it can add one layer of prevention, then I think we can at least feel like we've done something. And so that gives you a summary and an overview, and I think the most important thing is actually to hear testimony from those who have been victims, those advocates of the bill, and of course then those in the industry. So I'd like to...
That's fine. I see it in the A2 on lines 115 and 116. That gets the state and county and country in the clarified number A1.
Mr. Chair, yes. And as I mentioned, those who are advocates of this proposal would have also liked us to say city, state, or country. And so as this moves on, we're going to work with the industry to work on that.
Okay, let's thank you, Senator Bonnef. You have three. I have three witnesses.
Yeah, listed. And we learned that actually there's a fourth, because a woman named Maureen Torgerson actually took a 1:30 a.m. bus, drove all night to get here and share her story with us. So
oh,
we're
sure
adding
we
Maureen Torgerson. Jim Arlt will be testifying. Peggy Heistan Harry will be testifying. So if they could come to the table.
Okay, we want to hear from the folks that I assume got hurt by some of these actions. So you may, if you testify, just state your name for the record, would you please? And whoever wants to start, Senator Bonnef can have
Peggy.
Whoever you wish to.
Yeah. Mr. Chair and Senators, my name is Peggy Heistan, and I'm an ARP member from Duluth. I am here to tell my family's story about wire transfer fraud, a story that happens all too often across the state of Minnesota. On behalf of ARP, I'd like to thank Senator Terry Bonnef for listening to these stories and acting. You are providing the leadership we need to help wire transfer fraud, a devastating crime that caught my mother. Before I get into my speech, I want to share with you, last night I went back to the hotel room. I gave the speech twice. Press conference, and then for the House of Representatives, and I went back to my hotel room and looked at my mother's, the folder that I had made on everything she had done. And my mother is 85 now, and she does not have dementia. And she kept excellent records of what she did. And so about 2 years ago, I got these records and tried to make some kind of sense out of them, and I've kept them. So I went and I counted the wire transfers that she made.
40,000.
She made 8 wire transfers from Kmart, and that was through Western Union, and four through Super One, through MoneyGram in Duluth. So that was 12 opportunities that were missed. So I want, as I tell my story, and I'm going to warn you, I could get emotional. I have, and I don't want to, but I do. And as I tell my story, I just want you to think of those 12 missed opportunities. Over a period of 10 days in June 2010, my mother, who lives on a very small pension and Social Security, was considered into sending $47,000, which included $10,000 cash, to a Jamaican scam. How did this happen? A phone call from Jamaica advised her she had won $2.5 million and a Mercedes-Benz. I also want to point out I looked at the phone bill that was June 4th through July. She had a $508 phone bill from these calls she was billed for, and she did not get them collect. But the first phone call came on on this bill. It could have come, there could have been earlier, was June 4th. So they prepped her because she didn't start sending money till June 17th. Several calls later, she was convinced to send money for shipping the car. She was told that she won. During the period of the next 10 days, the calls kept coming, becoming more demanding and more personalized. They somehow knew that church was important to her, and the caller claimed to be a minister. The caller gained her trust and coached her exactly where to go to obtain cash advances on her zero balance credit cards. They walked her through exactly how to wire money. She had never wired money in her life before this, and told her to go to Kmart and or Super One in West Duluth near her home to wire it. This was incredibly easy for her to do. Not once was she stopped along the way. At one point, she actually withdrew $10,000 in cash, put it in an envelope, and traveled across town to mail it. Before we knew it, she had maxed out 2 0 balance credit cards and went into severe credit card debt. What we know now is that this scam stemmed from a hotbed of illegal criminal activity that targets older Minnesotans. These fraudsters either seduce vulnerable citizens to send money for promised goods or winnings that do not exist, or they convince them that their grandchildren or loved ones are in danger and they need them to wire money. Most people don't report this crime. In fact, experts say only 5% of the crimes are reported. It's too embarrassing, and law enforcement can do little to stop it. Minnesota needs to pass this bill to better protect its most vulnerable citizens, our elders. For our family, it was a year of heartbreak as we tried to help Mother. My mother, when she was age 83, had to file bankruptcy as her interest alone on her credit card debt was more than her income. We realized that there was very little we could do. Although we did contact the FBI, Secret Service, Homeland Security, Duluth Police, Postmaster General, Attorney General, and the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. The only help we received was from the Minnesota Department of Public Safety. Both my mother and I attended an ARP Fraud Fighters Forum in November 2010 in Duluth, where we heard from ARP, the Attorney General, and Investigator Jim Arlt talk about fraud. When he spoke about victims exactly like my mother, I finally realized we were not alone. Too many seniors across our state have lost their life savings. They feel so much shame, and they isolate themselves and suffer alone. Our seniors deserve more protection from fraud. Our taxpayers deserve it too, because millions of hard-earned dollars are wired down the drain every year. We need to be leaders by passing this legislation, and in doing so, provide a strong example of taxpayers protecting our most vulnerable citizens. Our elders have worked hard, paid taxes, and followed the laws. Now they need protection against this illegal activity. It's been almost 3 years since this has happened to my mom. When I asked her about it, what it felt like to hold $10,000 in cash as she put it in an envelope to mail it, she said, "I don't remember. They had my mind. I didn't know what I was doing." There has not been a day in her life since those 10 days in June of 2010 that have been normal for her. The outcome of this has been a nightmare. Not only has she lost her financial independence, her health has deteriorated. She has isolated herself, and she feels ashamed. These scammers not only took money from my mother, but her health and her spirit as well. On behalf of my mother and all the seniors across our state who have fallen victim to this crime, I would like to urge you to support the passage of this bill to protect seniors from wire transfer fraud. We have a duty to create a safety net to question, delay, and stop our most vulnerable citizens from wiring away their life savings. I never thought something like this would happen to my mother. Now I know it can happen to anyone, anyone's mother, neighbor, or friend. We all need to pay more attention to our elders and to pass strong laws that will help them avoid frauds. Many senior citizens are worth protecting. They are our mothers, our fathers, our grandmothers, and grandfathers. They protected us when we were young. Now we need to protect them. Please support this legislation, and thank you for your time.
Okay, excellent. Questions of the witness? Senator Bonnef, do you wish to introduce?
No, I just think, you know, Pei, I know it's very difficult and emotional to come down and testify, so we really appreciate you sharing your story.
Senator Carlson.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Heistand, was there something that, I don't know if we're going to hear more about this particular case, but I guess I would like to hear if there was anything that was done about it, any avenue that you pursued that got anything back or that identified anyone? Did you have caller ID records, anything like that that was followed up on?
I have a phone bill with the 800 numbers that I don't understand how this phone thing works, but they called her and they didn't call her collect. She never accepted a collect call, and when she got her phone bill, it was $508, and somehow it goes out to wherever it goes and it gets billed to her, and I still don't understand that. I did get the phone company to give her half. To credit her half, because they thought she was half responsible. But other than that, we kind of hit dead ends everywhere because this was overseas and it was out of their jurisdiction, and it wasn't $100,000. The $100,000, the FBI might have become involved because it was overstate. She sent money to Pennsylvania, to Massachusetts, Florida, and another state out west, I don't remember, but I have her records. And so she also sent cash and envelopes to these people, or checks. And one check she sent went to Maine, and was cashed in Massachusetts. And even the bank didn't want to help with that. And I would have thought that they would have had, a photograph of the person who cashed it. I went and interviewed the credit union where she took out $10,000 in cash. Now, this was a safety hazard in my mind to walk out. I mean, she's 110 pounds of fat in a rickety car in a not the safest part of town, 40th Avenue West. Senator Reinhart probably knows that part of town. It's not the
Duluth
safest.
Is safe. Duluth is safe.
Well, you know, there.
What are you talking about?
But
here, let me back up. You did say in your transcript here you'd contacted the FBI, Secret Service, Homeland Security, Duluth Police, Postmaster General. So apparently you tried to turn over every rock you could.
We did.
Yes.
And I suppose for some of these FBI and some of these outfits, it's probably not a big enough thing in their mind.
Right.
Maybe get bigger fish to fry. That's what I'm thinking. But they should investigate these things. But anyway, here we are today.
Yes, yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's why we're here.
Yes. So I have Ms. Torgerson, and again, we thank her for making the trip down.
Okay. Are you the one that drove at 1:40 this morning?
Uh-huh.
Where'd you come from, Alaska?
Fergus Falls. It felt like Alaska, but yeah.
You're not a pretty slow driver.
Oh, I rode a bus.
Oh, did you? Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming down.
Mr. Chair and Senators, I'm Maureen Torgerson, and I'd like to share my story of mental and emotional anguish with you today. I was married for 47 years and lost my husband a couple of years back. through the grieving process and just kept going, joining different clubs, functions, and whatnot, keep busy. And plus, I worked 40 hours a week in the health profession for over 30 years. If anyone has lost a mate through death or divorce, you know it's hard, and you cope however you can. And after some time, I started going online, and I went into social groups and ended up in a dating site, put my profile on and all that kind of thing, what you do, your photo, and I met some people, and one man struck me as being very kind and nice, and I started talking with him, and we had many, many conversations, and he just seemed like the best thing since ice cream, I guess, but anyway, he was from Georgia, and we talked every day numerous times, texting, phone calls, IM, emails, and he was a jewelry designer by trade, and he informed me that he was off to buy gold. He had acquired a big contract, and so he was going to get gold, and he usually bought in Italy, but this time the prices were down, so he went to Ghana. He was there about 3 weeks and ready to come back. He texted me and said he was running into financial difficulty and he couldn't get a hold of anybody to help him. Would I help? Well, I was hesitant, but then he'd also told me that he was coming to Minnesota as soon as he came back and we were actually going to meet, and I had figured, oh, this was great, you know, he's coming to see me. So, well, I wired Western Union some money to him, and happened again a couple more times. He just was having the worst luck over there. Finally, he was out of Ghana and on his way to the States, and then he hit London, and they informed him that his shipment was being held in London because of some document that hadn't been signed or fulfilled in Ghana. And he didn't know what he was going to do. He needed more money, and then I was kind of hesitant again, and I said, well, I just can't keep sending you money. Well, he said, I'll pay you as soon as I get back. So, again, I sent him money. Then he needed more money. This time it was a big amount, and I just went ahead and I went to the bank, and I bank-wired money because it was more than Western Union would tolerate. So I sent that money, and then he was off and finally got himself to the United States, and then he had more problems, and I refused to send any more money. I told him I thought he was scamming me. I said, I don't really know you, and oh no, he wasn't. He was going to be here, and he'd pay me back. I wasn't supposed to worry, but I was worried. I stopped. I decided that was it. I wasn't sending any more to him. Anyhow, when my husband was alive, but he was still in the hospital, we had talked for hours and hours, and he thought, we had a large dairy and grain farm. He thought maybe when he got out this time, we'd sell some land and just retire and enjoy our last few years together, however it would be, and we could live wonderfully that way. And so I put all this behind me and thought, yeah, we're going to do that anyway, and my husband had passed on. And I waited about a year. I decided to sell some land, and I did. And I made quite a lot of money on that, and I was doing well and thinking I was going to move out west and maybe enjoy some life. I have family out there. Well, in the meantime, my kids found out that I had sold land and that I had lent money to a scammer. And so they're now deeming me incompetent.
Oh, no.
And my money's being held hostage. I can't use it. So now I'm looking for work so I can support myself. And my kids have nothing to do with me. Mm. And I'm living with relatives because I can't live in my home. It's next door to my son's house. And he has assaulted me. And so my life has been turned upside down over this scam business. And I retired from my work in December. And now, looking for a job at this age is kind of hard. People are losing money every day through these scams, and I had no idea that it was a scam until it was too late. It's unfair that these professional criminals are out there. They have the upper hand, and they can walk away free with innocent person's money. And thank you.
Mr. Chair, I think bills like the one we're bringing forward today, they raise people's consciousness, and we try and put some precautionary measures in place. As you can hear from this story, I don't know that this bill would have done anything to prevent this, although perhaps some of the safeguards might have triggered some more suspiciousness if you are, you know, told that you have the right to see a receipt and that there's certain countries that are known for this, then perhaps your mind begins to ask questions and wakes up in a way that it wouldn't have been awake. And so while you could be sitting around the table and say, well, how would this bill have stopped that, I would ask you not even to go there, because I think anything that we do to put some boundaries around this practice can help.
Senator Mr. Ault.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonoff, I was going to ask if this bill would have affected, would have it impacted either case up there? And, you know, I can see if somebody requests to be on a no-transmit list that it would never happen again. But the question I guess I have is, how do we get people then to do the no-transmit list? I mean, usually they don't stay informed until it's too late. So that's my question.
Mr. Chair, and that's a good question, Senator Gazelka. One of the things is, as you heard, there were 8 or 9 times this happened. 12 times to Peggy's mom. And so what this bill does is, once it's happened once, then they are put on a list. And so they're arguably not allowed to do it again. So that's one thing. Another thing is when you think you're sending to one place and it's really sent to another and you're notified of that. Again, these are all, I can't tell you for sure, but and perhaps Mr. Ault, who hasn't yet had a chance to testify, but he's an expert in this. He actually used to work for the state of Minnesota. Perhaps he can respond to.
Welcome to the committee, and state your name.
Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Jim Ault. I'm now retired from law enforcement, but I had the privilege to serve the citizens of Minnesota for over 33 years. The last 21 years of my career, I worked for the Department of Public Safety in the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division. While working for the Alcohol and Gambling Enforcement Division, we saw an ever-increasing rate of complaints from Minnesota citizens about foreign lottery scams. Typically, these citizens were elderly. We started a program in the fall of 2007 that we called Min Scams. From that start date until I retired a year ago, we received over 100,000 complaints of frauds and attempted frauds, with reported dollar losses of between $4 to $5 million in each of the years 2010 and 2011. The Min Scams effort was mainly focused on receiving and investigating foreign lottery fraud complaints, because we were the Gambling Enforcement Division, and was conducted with limited resources. In fact, we received no extra monies for our efforts. It was just more, those resources were diverted from other things. It was not uncommon for an elderly victim of a foreign lottery scam to have sent all of the money available to them before a complaint was received by our division. Some of these victims had been threatened or had their lives of their grandchildren threatened if they had wanted to quit sending money and expressed that. Sometimes the elderly victim would be later tested and determined to be a vulnerable adult, as their mental cognitive abilities had declined. Families were extremely frustrated as they tried to keep their loved ones from sending money and desperate to find a law enforcement entity that would do more than just take the complaint and file it. Most of these senior citizens did not even know where their money had actually been received, even though they had paid a company to send the money and they had designated a location. The foreign lottery type of fraud is not going away, and if anything, it appears to be growing exponentially. According to a recent report, which was last month, of the United States Federal Trade Commission, the Jamaican version alone is reported to be bilking older Americans out of as much as $1 billion a year. Just older Americans from the United States. Jamaica is only one of a number of foreign lottery fraud receiving locations. The three largest frauds that target our senior citizens are the foreign lottery scam, the grandparent emergency scam, and the romance or relationship type of scams. If an intended victim of a grandparent emergency scam would be advised that the money that they had sent to North Bay, Ontario, was being attempted to be picked up in Montreal or Vancouver, that victim would be given a chance to realize it wouldn't make any sense. Why? It's because little Johnny's bail to get out of jail was up in North Bay, Ontario, not in Montreal or Vancouver. Just by now receiving the knowledge of the attempted receiving location, it could stop this crime from occurring. I had the pleasure of training and working with Canadian law enforcement assigned to investigate these crimes. I also traveled to Jamaica and worked with their Jamaican constabulary force when they conducted search warrants and arrested suspects involved in the crime. I saw the sucker, or intended victim list, that they were using and saw the names of people listed here in Minnesota. I was told by these law enforcement entities that their investigations had shown that organized crime or criminal groups were involved in perpetrating these crimes. In Canada, it was reported that traditional organized crime groups, Eastern European organized crime, and West African organized criminal groups were involved. In Jamaica, it was their gangs. Now, again, on these sucker lists are actually sold from group to group. They have value. And the more information that they have on the intended victim, the more value they have, because they can end up framing the scenario of the scam in such a way to give it more believability. So it could be if say, like her mother, if they were religious in nature, they may start up the scam of "you've been blessed by God" and go from there. The money transmittal companies used to facilitate a large percentage of these monies are acutely aware of these crimes occurring and the use of their services to facilitate the transference of the proceeds. Both of the major companies have been investigated by the National Attorney General's Association. MoneyGram has also been investigated by the Federal Trade Commission and most recently by the U.S. Attorney's Office. There is extensive public information available on the Internet as to the results of those investigations. At international law enforcement conferences, representatives of MoneyGram and Western Union have been asked about restricting the receiving of the monies to the location that the sender had designated. This change in procedure was requested for three reasons. First, so that the victim will have the information of where their money actually went when they report the crime. Second, so law enforcement could send money on the victim's behalf if we've interceded with them to get them to stop, and have other law enforcement investigate the criminals involved by identifying them from receiving the money. And last, so that the transactions where the monies are being received in a different location than the victim designated, this restriction may give the victim enough information to choose to not proceed with the transaction. Both companies' representatives stated that this would be a change in their business plan and could not be done independently as it would give their competitors a business advantage. Which I understand that if one company would require it to be picked up in a particular location, maybe some of this activity would then go to the other company. I strongly recommend the passage of the common sense proposals contained in this bill in the attempt to protect those Minnesota citizens that are most vulnerable to this crime. Again, I am retired. I am not here as a spokesman for any entity. I do have some experience in the investigations. Senator Clausen mentioned as far as caller ID. And to be honest with you, the caller ID information that people pay for really has no value, as I can make your caller ID show whatever I want it to show, whether it's your local police department, your local bank, pharmacy, or whatever I want. And, in fact, I can use a similar service and have them change my voice where I sound like a female. So caller ID at this point in time has no validity unless it's coming from a valid source that is willing to report what the caller ID information is that they want to show up on your phone.
Okay, so we heard in this committee, I believe, last week that fraud accounts for about $9 billion of ratepayers' or taxpayers' money in just the state of Minnesota. So these are incremental steps that we're taking, Senator Bonnef, and what I plan on doing is having kind of a task force this summer work on with Senator Jensen and Kosalka as kind of the lead on our committee to look into many areas of fraud. Mm. I mean, it's just so widespread, not just what you're talking about today, but in many, many other areas. And I think it's time for us to get a better handle on it and report back to the next Senate next year and really tackle this thing. And we can't do it all this year, so that's the intention of at least the chair. And I've talked to the chair of the House committee to expand what things that you're looking at, too.
So right. And so, Mr. Chair, I hope that, having said that, that you'll still move this bill forward this year.
Yes,
okay,
sir.
Good.
Okay.
But I strongly support that. Thank you. And I know the other person I just wanted to acknowledge, Jody Buell testified in the House last night, but we hadn't planned that our surprise guest, who we're very pleased that Maureen is here, and so in the interest of time, I didn't have Jody testify, too, but I do want to acknowledge Jody for the important work testifying that she did in the House and for her willingness to share the story, what a difference it made. And then I do have Michael Campion from MoneyGram as well.
Okay, any further questions of the... What time's your bus leave?
Tomorrow.
Oh, okay. Okay, we have Mr. Campion.
Yep. And also, Mr. Chair, it should be noted that the Commerce Department is very strongly in support of this bill and is prepared to answer any questions should somebody want to. Commissioner Rothman feels strongly in favor of this bill as well.
Campion, welcome to the committee. Identify yourself.
Mr. Chair, Michael Campion is my name. I work for MoneyGram International. I work for MoneyGram International for about the last year and a half. I work in the subpoena law enforcement liaison area. All day long, I talk to and I email and participate with people from the criminal justice system, all ends of it, throughout the entire United States and Canada, to do nothing but to assist them in getting data through MoneyGram or MoneyGram's data so they can investigate, prosecute, and prevent not only fraud that you've heard about today, but terrorism financing and any multiple degrees of money laundering. These stories are tragic. They're heart-wrenching. I talk to cops every day who investigate these kinds of crimes, again, throughout the entire United States and Canada. It's just simply heart-wrenching. For point of a clarification, MoneyGram has 631 businesses in the state of Minnesota. There's 100 MoneyGram businesses in the city of Minneapolis. There's 10 MoneyGram businesses in the city of Coon Rapids. There's too much probably data here, Mr. Chair, to cover, but just to give you kind of a scope of the problem, and I think in some respects that the data that Mr. Alters had in terms of the amount and the scope of the problem is different, I think, than what we see here in MoneyGram as of the last year and a half or so. Mr. Alt's data is 3, 4, maybe 5 years old. I wasn't working at MoneyGram when that took place or when that data was compiled. I'm sure he's probably accurate. MoneyGram has made enormous strides the last year and a half to minimize fraud in the state of Minnesota. Our statistics show that 0.04% of all reported fraud that goes from Minnesota to some other state are fraudulent transactions. That means 99.96% of the transactions in Minnesota are not fraudulent and, in fact, are legitimate transactions. Somebody said that these transactions and this crime is underreported. All crime is underreported. If you quadrupled that fraudulent statistic, any business in the country, bank or credit card, would be happy with that kind of credit card fraud. It would still be under probably what credit card fraud is 1.5-2%. MoneyGram has made a lot of strides because they have focused on the most adversely affected demographic, and in one respect, that is elderly people. They've done it by putting millions of dollars into technology. MoneyGram has the capability now of identifying transactions that have suspicious characteristics. If it's from Minnesota, it's a certain amount of money and it's going to Jamaica, that transaction gets flagged. Further investigation or review might require a hold being put on that, a preventative hold, that individual sender has to contact MoneyGram either by phone or email and has to answer a litany of questions before that transaction can be completed. We've also instituted a a PFC list, which is a technical term for a list where people cannot send transactions through MoneyGram. You heard the two people up here, their stories today. If someone would have interceded earlier on, called MoneyGram and said, here's a vulnerable adult, here's law enforcement, the family doesn't want that individual to, in fact, be able to send transactions anymore, we put them on a list that would prohibit them from sending any further transactions through MoneyGram.
Senator,
for a period of a year, perhaps, but
excuse me. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So are you saying that since I have an 84-year-old mother, I could contact you ahead of time before anything has ever happened and say it's in her best interest to not have a MoneyGram transfer? What would the procedure then be on your part?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I did one the day before yesterday. 83-year-old woman with no family in Canada who has had multiple transactions, law enforcement called and said, well, I don't know what to do. What can we do? No family. You write us a letter. It's a document the fact that you're obviously a legitimate law enforcement. We'll put her on a prohibitive list. She's on a list. She can't send any more money through MoneyGram. So the answer is yes.
Senator Kosoka.
Mr. Chair, to the testifier, so as a family member, if I had like a power of attorney, or would I have, what would the process be if it wasn't law enforcement for a family member to contact you?
You could, Mr. Chair, Senator, you could contact us. I would encourage you strongly to have a partner in that. Go to law enforcement and say, here's why I'm doing it. Here's the fraudulent transactions my mother's been involved with. I want to call MoneyGram. Would you support us? That's a good business model, not only for you, not only for law enforcement, but for money service businesses.
Mr. Chair, there's a provision in the bill that the Commissioner of Commerce could actually put them on the list, and so that this bill provides for that.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
Senator Pratt, did you have a question?
No, I'll let the witness testify first. Okay. Thank you.
Well, again, just the education, the partnerships, the PFC list, the technology is what's resulted in MoneyGram reducing fraud by an enormous amount of money. Out of $717 million that has left Minnesota last year through MoneyGram alone, just MoneyGram, I mean, there's only been $327,000 that's been identified by consumer complaints and others that has been fraudulent. Again, is it underreported? Of course it is. But quadruple that, it still is a minuscule amount of fraud compared to the volume. And it's in 2010, it was about 3.3% of fraud complaints. It's down to 0.04% now. So our focus is really on the vulnerable adults, the people who are most adversely impacted. Lastly, I will say we are generally very supportive of Senator Bonoff's bill. We appreciate the opportunity to be a partner with her in the Department of Commerce. There's good provisions in the bill, short of tweaking a thing here and clarification language there. The only real difficult thing that we have is the city, designating a city. And we have real strong opposition to that. First of all, from a technology standpoint, I'm not sure that we can even do it without a revamping of all of MoneyGram's systems in the United States. Second of all, it's completely unenforceable as we see it. How can Minnesota force other cities, the other 49 states in the United States to adhere to a rule that Minnesota legislature passes? And second of all, lastly, it won't have any impact. 59% of the fraud that came out of Minnesota last year in 2000 went to foreign countries. If you think a statute out of Minnesota legislature is going to have an impact in Jamaica or Mexico or any other foreign country, I mean, that's 60% of the fraudulent transaction. It simply will not work. And even if you designated a city in the state of Minnesota, there's 100 MoneyGram businesses in the city of Minneapolis alone. Which one do you designate? There's 10 in Coon Rapids. I mean, that's just not enforceable, and it simply will not have an impact. Our very strong support with this bill is the PSC list, or the limited ability to transfer list, and continue to focus on preventative aspects, because once this crime has been committed, when 60% of it goes to another country, I'm sorry, but we're not going to get that money back.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Bonoff.
Senator Gazelka, I would point you to Senate File 247, the A1 amendment, and it talks about how you can populate the no transmit list. And so the individual can request to put their name on it. Persons with legal authority on behalf of an individual can put their name on it. This bill actually is addressing exactly what you're concerned about, Senator Gazelka, because we often know the vulnerable isn't thinking, oh, I better put my name on a list, because if they were thinking that, they wouldn't do it in the first place.
Right.
So what we want to do is provide for support systems to make sure it doesn't happen. And with regard to this comment about the city, I still don't quite I'll wait till. I have a little bit of concern with regard to the comments on the city issue, because all we're saying is that if somebody thinks their provision is going to be, or their wire is going to be picked up in a city, and it turns out it was a different city, we're not asking for which place in that city, but we're saying if you think you're sending it to Raleigh, North Carolina, and it was picked up in another city far from Raleigh, then we want that to be flagged. And so we will work that out, but perhaps a compromise at the table is the word province in Canada, because you know, the story that was told about, well, Montreal versus Quebec, and if Canada is an issue, then perhaps, you know, at least we should have that in there while we work on the city issue.
Senator, Mr. Chair, Senator, we'll have a discussion about that. Be happy to have that discussion.
Where does this go from here, Senator Bonner?
Well, it goes to the floor, and that's where it is at the House, right? Oh.
Does the judiciary
expert? Oh, I don't know. Does
I thought
it?
They're filled up. I heard that. Let's find that out.
Find this one, Chair.
Has Senator Lance requested it?
We don't generally like to do the tweaking on the Minnesota Senate floor, so I just
I know. So
try
I'm
to figure out what we can agree with today. If there's something.
Have they?
I guess they have asked for it. I hate to do these policy things in another committee, but if you're that close, we'd probably let this one go. But unless you want to go out in the hall and work on it for 20 minutes and come back.
Well, we could just say we don't do city, but we do province, and we split the difference, you know.
Mr. Campion, want to split the donkey?
Mr. Chair, I'm not a policymaker. I'm just a humble employee at MoneyGram International. I certainly would be happy to engage.
It's our decision, not yours. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Campion, I'm wondering, because you're talking about, in the beginning here, about how many states and this is happening in, with your company. I assume your company is nationwide and in Canada. I think that's what you said, that your company is nationwide and in Canada.
Yes, Senator.
How difficult would it really be for you to also just add this to your nationwide system so that people from any state could put their name on a list like this, that would be your company policy to make sure that this doesn't happen, so that your company is not involved in this kind of fraud in any way, shape, or form, and is looked at as trying to stop this nationwide and in Canada. I mean, I assume that if Minnesota passes this law, it's going to do it's. It looks like a really good bill in the way that it's put together, Senator Bonoff. And I do think it'll protect people. Not everybody, but it will protect some people. How difficult would it be for you to, and I'm wondering why you haven't already made some policy changes within your company to make sure that people are allowed to get their name on a list, and no matter where that money is transferred from, which one of your offices, that office can just go on a national database that you have within your company and say, this person does not want any money transferred. That can't really be that difficult.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I've already testified that I just did that yesterday, day before yesterday. We do that already internally. We have done it. I've done it. I can't tell you how many times over the last year that we've put people at the request of local law enforcement or a family on this list. Not from Minnesota, but the one the other day was from Canada. We've done it consistently, and this is just formalizing what we've already done, and probably just expanding the fact that by law, this is what money service businesses are going to do. Not just MoneyGram, but Western Union also. Okay. And it's been a very effective policy, Senator. And again, we're supportive of that aspect of the bill. We think it's good. I even have a couple of suggestions. I was going to talk to the Senator about expanding it.
Right.
Well, we talk about that offline. But we're very supportive of it. We already do it and have done it for – we're doing it before I got there. We just started doing a little bit more of it when I got
there. Would you object to adding province?
Mr. Chair, I don't know the ramifications, frankly,
I'll
of that.
Wait.
I really don't know.
I can wait, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, I certainly understand the nature of the amendment, and but whether it can be done from a technology standpoint, I do not know.
Mr. Chair, have appreciated MoneyGram's willingness to work on the bill, and let's remember too that you know they're not the only actor in this industry, and so this bill is certainly not an anti-MoneyGram bill. And the other thing is members take some comfort in that in this bill there's also language that says once you're on the list, you have to stay on for a year. And prior to without this protection, somebody could be put on a Tuesday and then take themselves off it 2 days later. So,
Mr. Chair, if I could offer one other thing. These people that are around the state of Minnesota, around the country, and actually in 192 countries, they're not MoneyGram employees. They're independent contractors. 40% of MoneyGram's business is Walmart. Those are Walmart employees. Now, whether Walmart has the technology to narrow down transactions from Minnesota to Canada by province, I simply don't know, and I don't know what technology changes would be required. I mean, Ace and all of these other stores, Walmart, none of them are MoneyGram employees. They're MoneyGram contractors.
Senator Dames.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Bonhoeff, could you tell me what the cost of this bill? Did you receive a fiscal note on this bill?
I did not receive a fiscal note. Mm-mm.
Will that be received at some point before
it gets
to judiciary?
There's a question.
Well, let me make a suggestion on that. I say this about five times a year. Every time, are you listening? Every time we give a department just a little something more to do, we need three FTE units, whatever they're called.
FTE.
Just do it.
Right.
You know, I get tired of, you know, whatever department it is, pick one. Administration. You got 1,600 employees. So we ask the department to do something. We need 4.5 more people. Well, in my opinion, you can do it out of the 1,600 you have. So that's what I'm going to leave this with.
I don't think
we need more people.
Nope.
They can do it in the people they have in their department. I get tired of every little thing around here, I need more people. Well, that's, you know, you don't need more people. I love our workers. They all work hard. But tell me you could do just a little more. Okay, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman.
If you're against my statement, you.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwitty, Director of Government Affairs for the Department of Commerce, which has approximately 325 employees.
You've got a few people. Yeah.
Yes, sir. To my knowledge, we have not received a fiscal note request on this bill. So
you're not going after these statements that are made here.
No, sir.
Think about it, though. Okay, no, we're going to do it. If we do it past this bill, you're going to do it within the.
Yes, Mr.
The
Chair.
Money, the 325 employees probably have allotted to them or whatever's going on here. Okay, any further discussion? Senator Pratt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Campion, you talked about the technological concerns that you have.
Well,
as far as the receipt information coming back upon request, is that something that is that a generally accepted practice within your industry today?
Mr. Chair, Senator, I don't know if I completely understand what you mean.
The transmitter shall provide the sender of the money written verification of the location received and the name of the person receiving it. And I think, Senator Bonhoeff, you also talked about a photo ID as well.
No.
Sorry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pratt, we did amend that A1, and in the amendment, it actually gave a little more latitude with regard to that receipt that said, or the delegate, but because of the information I learned from.
I guess the return receipt, is that a generally accepted practice within your industry today, or is that above and beyond?
Mr. Chair, Senator, nothing in this world is simple. The short answer is yes, it's a standard practice. The problem is how that information gets conveyed. If I send you money and I'm defrauded and I go back to Walmart, can I get verification that it was picked up? Yes. You can probably get it from Walmart. Generally, what we do when they call MoneyGram, because we don't know who's talking on the other end of the phone, we tell them they must go to law enforcement and have law enforcement who we can verify that is a legitimate law enforcement individual we're talking to and it's a legitimate request. We always, and have for time been there and beyond, given that information to law enforcement, which can be conveyed to the sender. Otherwise, you open, if you're going to give information out over the phone to people who you're really not sure of, you are simply opening the door for more vulnerable adults to be re-victimized. Believe me. If you got information, they sent it, who they sent it to, who picked it up, what, the fact that they're sending it, you're going to have those senior adults, those vulnerable adults, be re-victimized again. So you have to have some legitimate way to substantiate the fact that it's a legitimate request, and law enforcement is the buffer there that makes these requests and this ability to transfer that information legitimate.
All right, I think we've had enough. This is pretty good. I think this is really a step forward, in my opinion, and I think it's got to get done. And Senator Pappas, did you?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll move that Senate File 247 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Okay, any further discussion on the bill?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dames.
I would just request we do get a fiscal note, though, so that the committee or that the department agrees that they're going to do it without any additional cost. So I'd request we get a fiscal note before we move that onto the floor.
Well, I think they've got some direction, but I go ahead, Senator Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, I actually don't know if they do fiscal notes unless it has a hearing in finance. Right. I think it's,
yeah,
I mean,
we don't
you
want
can
to send
request it,
it,
but they have a lot of fiscal notes to do. So typically they prioritize those bills
no
right
cost.
Before finance.
There's no, Senator Dames, there's no cost to the bill.
For the prohibitive list.
Commerce has told us there's no cost.
Okay, does that satisfy you? Okay. On the Pappas motion, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you very much. Thank the witnesses for coming forward.
And
it's not easy to talk about these things. Senator.
And Jones.
Who's?
He's on the committee.
Senator Seaman, are you ready? We're going to take you next because Senator Dahl, he's got to sit through the committee. Anyway, so. Senator Seaman, now this is the gold coin bill that I know you and I have had a lot of discussions on this, and the Attorney General, Commerce Commissioner, and you've been working on it, I know, for about 3 months. So let's see what it looks like. And there's a delete all amendment. That's the A6 amendment. Let's, Senator Carlson, to move that to get the bill in the shape that you'd like, Senator Seaman. So on that Carlson motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, motion prevails. Senator Seaman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your leadership on this issue and your willingness to work with me on this and the Attorney General's office on this issue. Members, Senate File 382 seeks to protect consumers that are being targeted by fraudulent coin dealers. You may recall reading about this issue in the Star Tribune in recent months. In fact, I think in your packets we had run off the series of articles about it. But primarily seniors, but Minnesotans are receiving unsolicited calls from some bad actors that convince them to pay large sums of money and never deliver the coins that they were promised. And so this bill attempts to chase those bad actors out of the market or out of Minnesota by requiring coin dealers to register with the Department of Commerce, complete a background check, and post a surety bond. And I just want to be real clear that our goal is to stop the offenders who are committing this fraud and not punish those good companies in Minnesota that are doing business honestly. So many of the changes that are we can describe in the A6 amendment are after we've worked with the industry to make some changes that they requested. The surety bond in the A6 amendment is capped at $200,000, which is consistent with other areas of statute where a surety bond is required. The definition of melt value is changed at their request, at the industry's request. Auctioneers are not included in this definition. And someone who occasionally would sell coins at a garage sale are exempted from the requirements, from these proposed requirements. So Ben Velzin, who's an assistant attorney general from the attorney general's office,
is here to answer questions or describe more of the bill. I'd also note that we have a letter in your packets from AARP who supports the bill, and a representative here from the Better Business Bureau who also supports the legislation.
Okay. So, sir, did you wish to comment?
Yep. Mr. Chair, Senators, my name is Benjamin Velzen. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with the Minnesota Attorney General's Office. And I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you very briefly today about the problem of fraudulent coin dealers in Minnesota. These fraudulent coin dealers often target senior citizens, as Senator Sieben referenced, and I have personally spoken with seniors who have been defrauded of thousands of dollars as a result of doing business with these dealers. Coin dealers that we're speaking about and those they employ often have lengthy criminal histories in our experience. They market coins to senior citizens and others as investments frequently, but then they simply fail to deliver the coins that the senior citizen or customer has purchased, or in other cases fail to pay the customer for coins they have sold to the coin dealer. Our office has received numerous complaints over the years about these types of practices, and many of these complaints do involve senior citizens, and I'll give you two very quick examples. In 2012, an 80-year-old man received an unsolicited call from a coin dealer based in Minnesota, and it convinced him to pay nearly $12,000 for gold coins. After the coin dealer electronically withdrew that $12,000 from the senior's bank account, the coin dealer never delivered the coins. Similarly, in May 2012, an 82-year-old woman received an unsolicited phone call from a Minnesota-based coin dealer. Again, the coin dealer convinced her to pay about $12,000 to purchase 10 gold coins. 2 days later, that senior citizen was admitted to the hospital and later a nursing home. And like the former coin dealer, the coin dealer never delivered the coins to the senior citizen. As I mentioned before, coin dealers frequently market coins, gold and silver coins, to seniors as investment opportunities, and unlike, for example, the securities industry, the insurance industry, the coin dealer industry in Minnesota is largely unregulated. Our office has filed 4 lawsuits against coin dealers over the last several years, and we believe that the problem is ongoing. I've continued to speak with seniors just last week who have continued to experience similar issues. I'll also point out, too, that federal authorities have criminally prosecuted coin dealers for fraudulent and problematic conduct in Minnesota. I believe Senator Sieben touched on several elements of the bill that I won't repeat, but I just wanted to highlight very quickly a couple of things the bill does not cover. The focus in this bill is to narrowly tailor it to address the problems I've just discussed. So, for example, the bill only applies to coins. It does not apply to jewelry, necklaces, or other precious metal products. The bill only applies if the coin dealer has engaged in $5,000 in coin transactions in the preceding 12 months. And the bill specifically excludes casual sales at like garage sales, yard sales, and the like. It excludes securities brokers from its coverage. It excludes wholesale transactions, so if a coin dealer sells or buys coins from another coin dealer, and it also excludes auctioneers. Lastly, I just want to highlight again that the bill does have the support of the Department of Commerce, the AARP, and the Minnesota Better Business Bureau, and that we've also been working with industry members throughout the process who have been supportive of our efforts to prevent and deter fraud in the coin industry in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One thing I didn't hear it all, Senator Sieben, but one very important part of this legislation is the Section 4 and Section 5. That's the background checks and the screening, and kind of gets to the bad actors. So I want to point that out, that that's a very important part of this legislation, where we get some background checks, and you hear people coming in from other states that have been guilty of this stuff and being able to kind of get by in Minnesota, and we don't want that to happen. So I think that's important to talk about criminal convictions, background, and the screening process. So.
Mr. Chair, thank you for pointing that out. You'll notice in Section 4, the criminal convictions, we've worked with the industry and others who were concerned that in the original definition of the bill, anyone who had been convicted of a felony was excluded from being able to be an agent, essentially. We narrowed it down in this amendment to make that restriction as you'll see on lines 512 to 521, essentially, so now it deals with people with felony convictions in the financial crimes area.
Good. Thank you for pointing that out. Any further discussion on this?
Mr. Chair, I believe that...
I'm aware of an amendment that you and I have talked about. It's not my amendment, but Senator Jensen, we've got a declining fee schedule on the bonding for the littler people, or not the littler dealers, because of that $200,000 is, in my opinion, pretty high, but I know Senator Jensen has...
Yes, I do.
...wanted to visit about that and has an amendment, and I think...
We can discuss that now, Mr. Chair. That sounds good. Or I also know that the representative from the Better Business Bureau would like to testify on the bill, too. But whatever your pleasure.
Have you guys seen the amendment? It's a decreasing scale, and I think it's fair. These real little dealers, a $200,000 bond, but it does bond them, but just not to the degree that you're trying to do. Let's talk. Let's Senator Jensen, I think you want to mention something.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. It's Amendment A7, and it's on page 6. Takes out the no less and based on line 13, and then sets a structure that's tiered rather than the straight amount that's currently in the language.
Mr. Chair, I would... consider this a friendly amendment. The Commerce Department supports it or is fine with language.
I know some people have visited with you before about this, and it's going to protect that little Main Street person that is not a great big dealer, and that bond could be $3,000-$4,000. So anyway, on the Jensen motion, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you. Do you have another witness or two?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Welcome to the Commerce Committee.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, my name is Barb Grayman. I'm the Vice President of the Better Business Bureau of Minnesota and North Dakota, the first Better Business Bureau in the world. We appreciate the opportunity to provide information on the subject of this bill. The collectible coin industry is today benefiting significantly from commodities prices, which are at historic highs. Minnesota is home to a large number of companies in these industries, and just as in every industry, there are those businesses which operate ethically and, of course, those that fall short. Some, in fact, fall notably short, as evidenced by recent actions taken by the Minnesota Attorney General's. What separates this industry from so many other industries we monitor is the lack of regulation, the amounts of money involved, and the fact that people, often retirees, are staking their nest eggs, their life savings, on these sometimes questionable investments and often unfulfilled promises. The BBB has received over 150 consumer complaints in these industries over the past 3 years, and we are troubled by common themes. Collection of large sums of money up front from consumers with coins or bullion not delivered in a timely manner, or in some cases, not at all. Coins being sold by consumers or shipped for sale or exchange, different coins of lesser value returned when the consumers decline the company's offer. Questions about the authenticity of coins delivered, and grossly inflated claims made as to promised returns. We have also seen at least two companies, Crescent Equities and the Stella Group, seemingly drop off the radar overnight into insolvency in the first case and a lawsuit filed by the Attorney General's office in the second case, but not before numerous consumers were bilked out of tens of thousands of dollars in some cases. In the case of the Stella Group, a company we have awarded an F rating, the BBB alerted the Attorney General's office to a spike in complaints, many very serious in nature. There have also been problems with other companies. Take, for instance, the case of the consumer who purchased or believed he was purchasing $190,000 worth of gold from Capital Trust Precious Metals. Over time, the company did return $100,000 of that money, but over the course of several months and after continued promises to refund the rest of that money, the company eventually disconnected their phones. To the best of our knowledge, the consumer never received the coins and is still out $90,000. One of the owners of that firm went on to spin off yet another precious metals company, Loyalty LLC. These companies have an F rating with the Better Business Bureau. Then there's the consumer who sent International Rarities Corporation over $18,000 in gold coins, which he wanted to exchange for collectible silver dollars. The company responded to the complainant originally by saying they had suffered an internal theft, which was tying up the transaction. They later responded that they were reorganizing under Chapter 11 bankruptcy to pay back their creditors. However, the company was converted to straight bankruptcy, leaving all debtors holding worthless debts, including the consumers. The owner of this company is now under federal indictment for $2.7 million in consumer fraud. The customer prospect list was sold to another company in the bankruptcy proceedings. We find that these companies morph from one to another identity with the same principles and the same business method. Then there's the elderly consumer who was convinced by a telemarketer to sell 1,000 ounces of silver to Crescent Equities in 2009. The customer then said he was persuaded to invest the proceeds of that sale in investment coins instead of receiving cash. A representative of the company asked the consumer if he had any other funds he might want to invest beyond that. The customer, who was over 80 years old, said he had $10,000 he was planning to bequeath to his son upon his death. Crescent salesman convinced the customer to invest that sum as well into coins that may or may not have existed. Within weeks, the company representative contacted the customer, saying that the coins had lost a lot of value. And at the very least, they were hoping to send him those coins along with a refund of some kind sometime soon. Unfortunately, the company went out of business, and the consumer never saw so much as a single coin. Again, company principals have been criminally charged, but it is noteworthy that they also already had criminal records for theft and fraud, as we find to be the case with other gold coin companies operating today in Minnesota.
Ma'am, you've got a lot of good examples there, and I think we've caught a few of them and understand them. You wish to give another one or two?
Okay, I'm all done with my examples. To summarize, I'd like to say, the BBB was founded and stands for industry self-regulations, but sometimes it just isn't enough to fight fraud. And cases like these clearly show the need for more oversight, including criminal background checks. And we would be happy to provide any further information from our files, the 150 complaints we have, which might assist the legislator in addressing this important issue. And if your committee would like, we can send that
Senator
to you.
Senator Sieben, did you have another witness or two that...
I don't, but I think there's someone else who'd like to testify.
You'd like to visit with the... Yes, yes, you may. You may proceed to identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senators, Senator Sieben, thank you very much for your input on this bill. My name is Gary Adkins, and I'm here basically to speak on behalf of most of the coin dealers in Minnesota who are what I call medium to smaller size businesses. There are a couple larger firms who employ hundreds, if not thousands, of people in Minnesota that do coin business. And I'm not here to speak on their behalf. They can take care of themselves. The coin and precious metals industry has had very little oversight in Minnesota. And obviously, most coin dealers would applaud some form of regulation that's reasonable, that sets reasonable standards for dealers to follow. We believe that all legitimate dealers will echo that statement because any bad apples make it difficult for all. And by the way, most of the complaints that you've seen in your packets, the news articles and so on, most of those people, they were a handful of people that were prosecuted, had nothing to do with our association or our dealers. Press releases have stated that most problems occur when non-delivery or churning of customers, as well as misrepresentation. We believe the legislation is a step in the right direction to protect consumers from fraud and abuse. Some consideration, however, needs to be given to the unintended consequences of the legislation as drafted. We will concede that some of our concerns have been addressed by the Attorney General's office. The bills still reflect, however, a broad and overreaching effect that will be felt by hundreds of businesses and thousands of workers in Minnesota. And by the way, I'd like to thank you for making this amendment and passing this amendment. I think this is a big part of some of our objection is the bonding part of it. Minnesota businesses that buy and sell coins and precious metals are widely diversified and employ thousands of people. These businesses include coin and precious metals dealers, as well as antique dealers, pawnbrokers, jewelers, etc. All of these businesses fall under the current legislation as drafted and are also regulated by municipal laws known as secondhand dealer laws. We would suggest that if the law is passed, many of these businesses may not be able to meet the financial burden or be able to get the required bonding, even though they might be a legitimate business. Bonding is a difficult process and confusing even to the insurance agents offering them. It's not fair to a legitimate business employing thousands of people to suffer for the acts of a handful of criminals. Many of the businesses that would be hurt most are legitimate small business. The Attorney General has stated there are about 100 complaints. Most of these are centered around a handful of criminals who call themselves coin dealers, and basically these people are merely scripted salesmen that are just out to sell products quickly, make a big profit, and then go away. Most of them have no conscience. Definitions within the proposed bills are a little problematic and not all-encompassing. The term bullion and coin dealer have limited effect in accomplishing the intended oversight. As drafted, the bill affects all of the above-listed businesses, not just coin dealers. Bullion would include any coin with 1% or more precious metal and does not include bullion bars or metals. Precious metal products might be a more appropriate terminology for covering all these products and the oversight. The Attorney General has stated also earlier that about half of these 100 or so complaints are results of out-of-state purchases. This is an unintended consequence of current sales tax imposed on precious metals purchases in Minnesota. These products are generally purchased as investments, are mostly money, and should not be taxed. You can purchase precious metals from a commodities broker in Minnesota, take delivery, and not have to pay sales tax. Why should it be any different for precious metal dealers? Consumers are being put at risk dealing with out-of-state dealers because they don't want to pay an additional 7% tax on top on that investment. Millions of dollars in business revenue is leaving our state as a result, and consumers are put at substantial risk of being defrauded from out-state, creating little or no recourse for them. This legislation provides protection for them in Minnesota, so why not pass an associated exemption bill and fall in line with 32 other states that now exempt precious metal sales? If you want consumer protection on precious metals, this is the biggest obstacle in the state of Minnesota. We're also losing revenue from conventions that would come here with revenue generation of to tune of $10 million or more. Our aim is to enhance the legislation and its enforcement, yet simplify the process and protect the law-abiding businesses that support the employment and tax base in Minnesota. As it is drafted, it's difficult for dealers to fully support the bill. And attached, and I've passed out a copy of it, is our concerns regarding the bonding, and you've addressed that, and we really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any comments, Mr. Attorney General, or any rebuttals on some of those statements? Sir?
Mr. Chair, just very quickly, if I understood Mr. Atkins correctly, one of his concerns is that the bill doesn't cover enough precious metal products. The bill, as written, only applies to coins. And the reason for that is that we were trying to craft a narrowly focused bill, and we have seen the problem primarily in regards to precious metal coins and coin dealers. So that's why the bill is targeted at that. To the extent that Minnesota consumers have had issues with other precious metal products, we would, of course, encourage them to get in touch with the office, and we can go from there.
So Senator Stevens addressing a very critical issue, and maybe going forward later this year, next year or something, we can expand things. But I think you're kind of totally pretty much in agreement with what we're trying to do here. Is that correct? And we helped you on the bonding thing, I think, or Senator Jensen did.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The bonding was a big issue because a lot of small dealers can't afford to get a bond, and many of them may not really, because of their financial condition, may not qualify for a bond, especially in financial crimes type situations like you're speaking of. So that was a big issue that has been overcome, and I think that's great that was passed here today.
Senator Jensen's I agree with the amendment. But, any further questions or comments from the citizens at large? But I think the agreement is pretty much there. And then, again, that bonding thing helps a little bit. So I think this does have to go to judiciary, but this is the policy committee. So,
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'd just like to remind you that this bill does throw out a wide net and includes people that are in the antique business, pawnbrokers, anybody that's dealing in coins, precious metals that meets the definitions in this bill would be covered by this legislation.
I think we heard some testimony, but Attorney General, you might repeat what I thought I heard a little while ago.
Mr. Chair, the bill attempts to be narrowly tailored in that there's exclusions for various classes of industries, auctioneers, securities brokers, so on and so forth. And then in addition to that, in order for the bill to apply, the person needs to sell $5,000 in aggregate coin transactions over a 12-month period. So if it's just a pawnbroker, somebody selling a few coins here or there, they would likely be excluded under the bill.
Does that satisfy you? I think that's what I heard earlier, too. So.
No, I heard that as well, and I agree that that some transactions will be below that that figure. But believe me, there's a lot of pawn dealers in the state that are doing a lot more business than $5,000. So, and same thing with antique stores or jewelers. Thank you.
All right. Any further discussion on Senator Stevens, Senate Bill 382? Senator Goodwin would move that Senate File 382, as amended, be recommended to pass and forwarded to the Judiciary Committee. Further discussion, Senator Dames.
Mr. Chair, thank you, and I would hope that Senator Stevens, that you would work with the folks there. There seems to be a difference of opinion between the gentleman, Mr. Atkins, and the person Attorney General's office. So I'd like to make sure that we all are on the same page. So if you could work that out before we get the goes to where does it go next?
Judiciary,
I would appreciate that.
Senator Kosalka, did you have an
opinion? Yeah, Mr. Chair, I'm willing to move it forward, but I would like to see us find a little more common ground there at the end.
Mr. Chair, I'm happy to work with Mr. Atkins on the definition of or that $5,000 threshold if that's the concern.
Atkins, is that agreeable with you?
As was stated, though, I think with the surety bond language that Senator Jensen moved, that gets a little.
That helps us. That helps. I think that helps quite a bit. I think that's. All right. We the promise is there that the dialogue could still continue.
Yeah.
Expect any major changes, quite frankly, but you could tweak it a little bit if everybody's in agreement. Okay. On that motion, all in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Stevens, and thank you, Attorney
Mr.
General,
Chair.
And thank you, Mr. Atkins.
Thank you.
Now, the last bill on the schedule today is Senate File 586, Senator Dahl, Debt Management and Debt Settlement Provisions Modifications. So. Jim. Do you want to do this right away? Carlson.
Take this for a minute.
I think you might want to put that on right away. Okay. That's Senator Dahl.
It's thinned out dramatically.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dahl, you have
Senate File 586.
586.
And I'd like to move the A1 amendment, first of all, to put the bill in the order I would like it to be.
Senator Dahl moves the A1 amendment to Senate File 586. Is there any discussion about the A1 amendment? All in favor of the A1 amendment, please signify by saying aye.
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 All opposed, same sign. Motion passes. Senator Dahl.
Mr. Chair and members, I just want to give you a little background information on the debt settlement bill that's before you, and then I'll allow you to answer questions. And I have also Ron Elwood here from Legal Aid that will probably be the expert on how this bill came to be. This bill amends the Minnesota's debt management law and Minnesota's debt settlement law. Debt management is a response to a debt where the consumer works out an arrangement to pay 100% of the debt over time, while debt settlement, on the other hand, seeks to get the creditor to accept some cents on the dollar. In the mid-2000s, consumer abuses in these industries became so rampant that the U.S. Congress held hearings. Actually, former Minnesota Senator Norm Coleman was leading the efforts on debt management, and the Federal Trade Commission actually investigated. Attorney generals, banking regulators, and credit counseling agencies across the country were being inundated with complaints of debt settlement companies taking exorbitant upfront fees and then failing to provide any services that they promised. The quick fix promised by these outfits for desperate people in debt rarely materialized. Congressional hearings, the FTC, banks, and creditors found many of these outfits to be harmful and not helpful in collecting debts. Banks and creditors frequently just simply refused to deal with them. In 2007, the Minnesota legislature enacted the debt management law, and in 2009, the legislature enacted the debt settlement law. These are chapters 332A and B. There are now nearly 50 registered debt management and debt settlement companies in Minnesota authorized by the Department of Commerce to provide those services. In 2010, to address the rampant problem of upfront fees being paid without any services, the Federal Trade Commission amended its telemarketing sales rule to require services to be performed first before the fees are paid. That rule, however, is only limited to interstate solicitations over the telephone. The 2007 and 2009 laws passed by this legislature did contain certain exemptions. One was for attorneys. However, the intent of those exceptions were to include those attorneys whose principal or exclusive practice involves debt management or debt settlement, but exclude those who perform debt management or debt settlement incidental to their regular practice. In other words, the exemption was intended to be qualified and not absolute. Since then, state regulators and the Attorney General have had persistent problems with out-of-state attorneys and law firms claiming absolute exemption. So this bill does three things. One, it makes it clear that if attorneys are in debt settlement business, either directly or indirectly, they are covered by Minnesota laws, and if they're unaffiliated with a debt settlement company or not in the debt settlement business, they're exempt. The bill also extends the Federal Trade Commission's telemarketing sales rule to all debt settlement transactions in Minnesota, whether solicited by phone or email or other advertising, and finally provides the contracts that contracts must be written and disclosures must be given in the primary language which the contract was negotiated. This bill is needed because out-of-state attorneys whose primary business is debt settlement are flaunting the law, and debt settlement companies are using rent-an-attorney subterfuges to circumvent our law. The amendment tightens the language closing the attorney exemption loophole to ensure that it's not too broad to sweep in those general practitioners who occasionally help clients with debt problems, but sufficiently clear to include only those in the business. Last year, the attorney loophole closing section was offered as a standalone bill that actually Senator Chamberlain carried. The Debt Settlement Trade Association, which is the American Fair Credit Council, testified in support of the provision. The American Fair Credit Council also had its own bill. Senator Chamberlain carried that bill that included extending the FTC rule that is included in this year's bill. They do not oppose this bill. In addition, this year's bill has been vetted with the Minnesota Department of Commerce, Minnesota Bankers Association, Minnesota State Bar Association, the Independent Community Bankers of Minnesota, and the Minnesota Credit Union Network. None of these groups have a problem with this bill. With that, Mr. Chair, members, I'll stand for questions or clarification.
Senator Dahl, do you have a testifier who would wish to speak on this?
I'll let Ron Elwood weigh in if you'd like.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ron Elwood with Legal Aid, thank you for the opportunity, and thanks, Senator Dahl, for carrying this bill.
We've been involved in this issue from the inception, and I think Senator Dahl said it very well. I did want to mention that I believe I was informed that there was a letter also in your packets from Lutheran Social Services. I don't know if it made it in, but they are also in support of this bill, because they're seeing the problems as well. I'll only say this before I let – I know that this committee's gone very long, and we don't want to spend any more time than necessary, but you're going to hear from our opponents next. I'll let them speak for themselves, but they will they're an out-of-state law firm that would prefer us not to close the attorney loophole. And I would just, as you listen to that testimony, I would just ask you to think about this question, because that's the crux of it, which is, should we all be playing by the same rules, or should some be able to play by different rules just by dint of the fact that they happen to be attorneys? And I'm sure we'll have a further discussion about that after their testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. I believe we would go with the opponent testifiers now.
Senator?
Yeah.
Mr. Please, Chairman?
Please state your name for the record.
Yes.
And continue with your testimony.
My name is Neil Ruther. I'm an attorney, and I'm the managing member of Purcell & Associates, a law firm. We've had discussions with Mr. Elwood about this, and let me start by saying that we both disagree and heartily agree with his goals. Rather, we agree with his goals, but not the method of getting there. My law firm has 180 attorneys in 47 states. We've represented over 37,000 clients these last few years. We provide a great deal more than simply debt settlement services to clients. In fact, it is our view that no one but a licensed attorney in this state should be advising clients about reducing their debts. This practice is nothing more than a common law composition with creditors. It's a bankruptcy reorganization outside the scope and purview of a federal court. It's been going on for hundreds and hundreds of years. When you say to a client that you, in order to stay out of bankruptcy, ought to attempt to negotiate compromises with your creditors, you're giving legal advice to that client that is in both explicit and implicit. You are saying to that client, I understand what the laws of this state are as they relate to exemptions. I understand the nature of the title of your property. I understand what creditors can and cannot do if they get a judgment against you. I understand what the bankruptcy laws are, and I'm capable of advising you of all of those things. We do that. When our clients are sued, we file responses to the lawsuits. We respond to motions for summary judgment. We propound discovery. Many of the debt buyers who buy these debts hundreds of millions of dollars at a time know that they own the debt but cannot prove how much it is. We file documents with the courts that result in the dismissal of those lawsuits. We are not a debt settlement company. What the proponents of this bill have argued to you, and they are correct, is that there are a number of debt settlement firms out there who have sought to evade the purposes of your law, which was never intended to direct its provisions to the practice of law, by merely getting a lawyer to sign on the dotted line saying, I represent these people. They have no contact with the clients. They don't do anything if the client gets sued. They don't advise them about what their alternatives are. And they do nothing to protect them against overly aggressive collection techniques, as we do by filing lawsuits in federal court under the Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act. So why do we object to the provisions of this bill? Simply because it attempts to solve a very specific problem by casting a very broad net. My law firm's practice is concentrated in the field of debt, although, as I said, we do Federal Fair Debt Collection Practices Act, we file bankruptcies on behalf of clients, and yet this bill would subject us to regulation as it is currently stated. Do you really want to enact a law that says to lawyers that only inexperienced and ill-equipped attorneys in this field may negotiate compromises of debt? Or do you want a firm that does hundreds of thousands of those transactions, has data on what creditors will do and not do, has filed lawsuits to prevent harassment of the clients? Do you want those people doing this work? Well, by saying that if a lawyer principally does this,
They are regulated by the state and the fees that they can charge, fees that are intended to limit a non-lawyer's compensation. These people are not providing legal services to these folks. They're being limited in their fees because they don't do any legal work. Do you really want to say, as a matter of policy in this state, that we're only going to allow people who have limited experience in this field to do this? The second problem that we have is our law firm has been providing unbundled legal services since 1997. Unbundled legal services are a relatively new development in the field of the law. It's designed to assist people who are economically foreclosed from the mainstream of legal practice. You go to one of your district courts, your lowest court, where all of the credit card companies file these actions against citizens, you will find 40, 50, 60 cases on the docket every day, and not one of those people is going to have an attorney there to represent them. Why? Because it doesn't make any economic sense for an attorney to represent someone at $200, $250 an hour to defend a $2,000 claim. What happens in that court is that even if there is an attorney there for the client, there's going to be a judgment rendered against the client, and now the client has a $2,500 bill. Our practice is designed to give these people limited and very inexpensive legal help that can be used to defend themselves and vindicate their rights and then mitigate the effect of any judgment that might be rendered against them by competently negotiating compromises of the debts once a judgment is rendered. Let me give you an example of what this bill would preclude by saying only practitioners who are handling a divorce or some other matter can negotiate these debts. One of the biggest problems that our clients have is they don't know who owns the debt. You borrow money from Discover Card. They write it off after 90 days. They sell it off in a package $100 million at a time. You have no way of knowing that it's been sold. You don't know to whom, and you don't know what they're going to do about it. We have the experience and the agreement with those creditors to find out who owes the money, and to get contact with them so that we can negotiate those debts. And I assure you, we're very, very successful at it. By passing this legislation, you're going to put every consumer, every client who's indebted to a credit card company at 34% interest in the position where they're not going to have access to that kind of knowledge and service. If you want to stop, and I think you should, the rental lawyer syndrome, the company that just comes in and gets a lawyer to sign on the dotted line, there's a way to do that that's very simple. It's one that was enacted by the National Commission on Uniform Laws and is now in effect in six other states in the District of Columbia. And what that law says is that you've got to have a legitimate lawyer-client relationship arise before the exemption takes place, in which there are legitimate legal services being offered and provided to the client by a licensed attorney in the state of residence of the client. I understand that there may be an amendment offered. We hope there'll be an amendment offered which adds an additional requirement that there not be an intermediary, that is someone who takes over the representation between the attorney and the client, and that's fine with us. Ladies and gentlemen of the committee, I thank you very much for your attention. I could add perhaps some additional heat, but little additional light. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Ruth. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify? And Mr. Elwood, do you have more to say?
Well,
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, I mean, I think I'd like to take your direction. I could certainly rebut many of the statements made. It's up to you. I would like to point out one thing, at least, if this is the only amount of time you have, which is the debt buyer problem that was alluded to. Actually, Senator Latz has a bill that would be addressing that problem, so that really would be moot. Again, I'll take your direction as to a detailed rebuttal, but if not, then let me just say this. I think that what this really is about is circumvention of our law. That's simply it. And two, folks wanting to play by different rules, there are a number of protections in our statutes that are important. This would allow, if this exemption loophole was not closed, higher fees could continue to be charged. The disclosures that are required wouldn't be given. There would be no upfront analysis of whether this is a suitable response to the debt. There would be no remedies available in case of a problem arising. And I'll stop there unless you'd like a significantly more detailed rebuttal to each and every point.
Thank you, Mr. Elwood. Senator Latz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What I'd like to do is to offer an amendment for discussion purposes to give the committee an opportunity to consider it and to hear from the testifiers as to, or anyone else that has input on it.
Do we have that amendment?
That'd be the A13-159 amendment. I have it here.
Senator Latz offers the A13 amendment. Passed out here. Perhaps you could describe what's contained in it.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman and members.
Senator Latz.
This amendment changes the definition of attorneys exempt from the bill. And I'm not sure exactly how it fits in with procedurally with the amendment, the A1 amendment that was adopted at the beginning of the proceeding. But it addresses essentially the same question, at least as to subdivision 10A. And it approaches it a little bit differently. And I would ask I expect the testifier from the Maryland law firm is familiar with the content of the amendment, and I'd ask if he could explain specifically how this fits, how it is different from the language that's in the now amended bill, and whether the amendment is, in fact, the Uniform Law Commission language to address these issues.
Do you have a copy?
Senator Letts, you're addressing Mr. Luther?
Mr. Luther, yes.
Do you have
Could I have the page give me another copy, Mr. Chair, of the
original bill?
The amendment?
I can address this.
The Latz amendment.
Yes.
We need three.
This is essentially the incusal. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Yeah. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Go ahead. I'm just identifying you.
This is essentially the incusal language. And I might point out that the National Commissioners on Uniform Law studied this issue for well over 3 years. And the members of that committee were representatives of the American Bar Association as well as people involved in the non-lawyer aspects of this industry. And their goal as well was to prevent the very kinds of evils that Mr. Elwood seeks to prevent here. They were as sympathetic to that as well. The provision simply says that you must not only be a lawyer in this state, but you must demonstrate in order to be able to take advantage of the exemption that you are providing legal services in an individual relationship with a creditor. That has a very well understood meaning. It is enforceable by your state bar authorities. It is enforceable by the Supreme Court of this state, and it certainly is enforceable by the Attorney General. The provision that there's no intermediary between the individual and the creditor other than the attorney or an individual under his direct supervision prevents an attorney from merely signing his or her name to a representation agreement and having no further contact with the client and yet taking advantage of the nature of the exemption. I might point out that when this legislature enacted the limitations on fees, it did so to restrict what a non-lawyer, a person without a legal education or a license, might charge for merely rendering the service of, I'll call your creditor, I'll tell them we owe you a dollar, I've got 20 cents, would you like to have it? That's not necessarily a legal function. Although I might point out that the Supreme Court of Georgia and the Supreme Court of the state of Ohio have said exactly that, that it is a legal function and that only lawyers ought to be doing this. But be that as it may, the fee structure was designed to limit the amount that non-lawyers could charge who were not delivering any legal services at all. We don't think that it's good representation to tell these people they can compromise their debts without all of the advice that a lawyer ought to be given. And while we're on that subject, the suggestion that we do not give the kind of advice that the bill requires be given to these clients, with all due respect, is simply wrong. We've given Mr. Elwood a copy of our disclosure statements and our retainer agreement, and we tell these people, just as your bill requires, that if you can afford to pay your bills, don't do this. If you can't pay your bills, this is going to harm your credit. You may be sued. Your wages may be garnished. That's something that any lawyer who understands this kind of a representation is going to tell a client anyway, purely as a matter of competence. You do not need to get into the office of every lawyer in this state and pass a law that says this is what you need to say to a debtor in order to be competently representing your client.
Mr. Elwood, you have a response?
I do, Mr. Chair. First of all, the definition of the services provided was referred to as legal services. In our statute, they are defined as debt settlement services, which would require, we think, regulation. Second of all, this legislature did not distinguish fees for non-lawyers and lawyers. I can tell you that because I was here. I was involved in that legislation. I drafted much of it, and I testified on all of it. And I can tell you for absolute certain that there was no distinguishing between the fees between a lawyer, what a lawyer would charge or anybody else would charge. And perhaps this particular law firm does not or follows some or all of the provisions in our statute. But if we created the blanket exemption and we didn't clarify what the original intent was, then maybe some other law firms, and we know that other law firms, are flaunting the law. And while the provisions that may already be followed that were described, what about the fees are definitely higher. We already discussed that. I don't believe there's any preliminary requirements followed that what others would be required to follow, like suitability evaluations and ensuring that the creditors are actually going to play ball so people don't get strung along forever and for 2 or 3 years and don't even where the creditor would never talk to them in the first place. And by the way, there would be no statutory remedies available because they would be exempt. So, again, the question, I think, the fundamental threshold question is, why should we treat lawyers doing the same thing differently? Why should we do that? What is the public policy behind that? And certainly a firm from Maryland who hires a couple of attorneys here to circumvent the law and take advantage of our of the alleged exemption, which, again, it was never intended to be. If you're in the business, you should be covered. If you're not, then no. But how would that help a debtor who was aggrieved when you have essentially a just a person here who's just under contract, not under contract to the consumer. The consumer is under contract to the out-of-state company. So to even get at them, they're in a whole other state. So we believe, in the debt management circumstances, I think we have many, many, many out-of-state companies that are here operating under the law without problem. And this is a much more serious arena. So I would urge you to reject these amendments, to pass the bill as we amended it here. And by the way, this amendment was intended to even further narrow the ability of attorneys not to get swept up in a regulatory structure where they don't really belong. So, for example, if you're an attorney who's a general practitioner and somebody comes in and you do an estate plan and the next client comes in and you're handling a DUI and the next client comes in and you're dealing with a contract dispute and the next client comes in and he wants to settle some debts, no. That's what this amendment does, make sure that attorney does not have to comply. But if your business is debt settlement, then why should you be exempt?
And Mr. Chair, he's talking about my amendment, not the Latz amendment, which we have added to the bill, at least in terms of discussion. Again, I think I don't speak much legalese, and there's being surrounded by a lot of it. But really, this is all about consumer protection. This is about a group that is claiming exemption, but we feel that they should follow the same rules that every other debt management firm is playing by in Minnesota. That's the bottom line. And again, if he claims that they are doing a lot of those things, then I don't believe that this legislation should be harmful. So I'm going to respectfully urge you to vote against the Latz amendment this time.
I only have one other very brief comment, and that is within 2 miles of where we're sitting right now. I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Within 2 miles of where we're sitting right now, there must be 200 law firms that are out of state who practice here. That does not mean we do not respect your laws. It does not mean we are not subject to the jurisdiction and supervision of the state's highest court or its enforcement mechanisms. We are, and those mechanisms are important, and they are effective.
Thank you, Mr. Ruther. Senator Latz, on your amendment that you brought up for discussion.
Yes, thank you.
Would you like to proceed?
Well, I'm trying to evaluate this because, frankly, I'm a little bit torn. As Mr. Elwood knows, I'm a strong advocate for consumer rights and consumer protection. On the other hand, there is something to do with attorney-client relationships and privileges and representation that typically would involve more than just trying to get a debt settled. And so I'm trying to balance this here as to, and maybe it's just a question of what exactly are law firms doing differently from a more typical debt settlement company, such that they ought to be regulated differently than a typical debt settlement company. And that's what Mr. Luther is trying to explain, is that they do something different. They offer a broader range of services. It's based on more knowledge, more expertise, more advice, what have you. And what I'm trying to struggle with, is that really something that has a meaningful difference in this field? And the other thing that's got me a little bit hung up is that if the Uniform Law Commission has looked at this very issue and has proposed language such as is in my amendment to address the issue, I'd really like to hear directly from the Uniform Law Commission, because, you know, we adopt a lot of stuff from them, and they are deserve and are entitled to a lot of respect in terms of how to address issues and statutory formulations. So I wonder if maybe Mr. Elwood can shed some more light on that for me to evaluate this.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, actually the uniform law model was introduced in 2009 here when the bill was introduced, that the law that's introduced that is now the law. The bill that was introduced is now the law. The two were compared, and it was clear that the Minnesota model was significantly more protective, and the uniform law approach was a more of a compromised, watered-down protection. I will tell you that I was on the website of the Uniform Law Commission last night, looked up this bill, and I can tell you it is adopted in exactly one state, and that is Utah. Now, there may be provisions that are taken in a couple of other states, but very, very frequently these uniform laws are sort of the watered-down version that gets compromised out, and oftentimes Minnesota goes farther. And we did here, and we should stay there, and I think that's the very key to this.
So, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Latz.
Mr. Elwood, help me understand how the services that Mr. Luther's law firm provides are similar enough to the more typical debt settlement company that the bill is focused on, that they ought to be swept into the regulation instead of exempt.
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair and Senator Latz, so I'm glad you asked that question, because the extent to which I think it was discussed before, if a party is sued and they want to provide advice on how to fill out forms and they want to represent them in court, which, by the way, they do not. But if they did, if they wanted to provide strict legal services, they would not be subject to any provisions of Chapter 332. That's a strict legal arrangement, and those are strict legal services. But if they're starting to get into the negotiations with the creditors and the machinations and the mechanisms of the way debt settlement works, put your money in an account for 2 or 3 years until we have enough money to build it up so that we can now get to the creditor and offer a settlement. We're going to take some fees out every month for our own fees out of your account. We will negotiate with your creditors under the rubric of getting a cents on the dollar settlement. That would fall within the rubric of our statute. But if they want to tell them how to fill out a form to defend themselves against the lawsuit, no, they're not covered by Chapter 332. That's if they have a licensed lawyer here to do that, fine. We don't care. And in terms of the court regulating these services, that's all well and good. Of course the courts regulate lawyers. But how does that help the consumer that's been fleeced by an unscrupulous law firm? How does that help one consumer? They're not going to go to the – great, they'll go to the professional lawyers board and have the attorney disbarred. But what does that do for relief and compensation for the customer who's lost thousands of dollars to an unscrupulous operator? Nothing. So, again, I think it's essential that we make sure that everybody plays by the same rules. And the last thing I'd say is I frankly think this is an anti-competitive approach because why should one group of folks charge significantly higher rates or higher rates, different rates, operate under different rules? This is not like buying a car. People don't shop around for these services. They get solicited, or they go on an internet, or they see something on the TV. This is not – so I think this, you know, by allowing – just because you're a lawyer, you shouldn't follow the rules. It strikes me as setting up a very anti-competitive and unfair business system.
Mr. Chairman?
Mm-hmm. Senator Letts.
Well, a question and a comment. As to the comment, there is a system in Minnesota, and Mr. Elwood, you know this, that if someone has lost money because of a lawyer's misconduct, there is a compensation fund that is available and funded through the IOLTA accounts, among other places, through lawyers' fees and interest on the lawyers' trust accounts to provide compensation to clients that have lost money. But that's not really the issue. To me, and maybe I just need some more information on Chapter 332, does it categorize the names of the businesses or the companies that are subject to its regulation, or does it say if you're providing debt settlement services A, B, C, and D, no matter what form of organization you take, then you are subject to this regulation?
Mr. Elwood.
Mr. Chair, Senator Letts, yes, it defines what debt settlement services are. The offering or providing of as an intermediary between the debtor and one or more creditors, where the primary purpose is to obtain a settlement for less than a full amount, advising and encouraging or assisting and counseling a debtor to accumulate funds in an account for future payment of a reduced amount of debt. It's defined specifically in statute. There is a, and again,
go on, Mr. Elwood.
Yes.
Is there more? You stopped after two. Are those the two criteria?
Those are the two criteria. Any person so engaged or holding out is deemed to be in the debt settlement, providing debt settlement services.
Okay.
Senator Lutz.
Chairman, Mr. Luther, does your firm do those two things?
Our firm does those two things, but it does not do it as a lay provider of those services. There are many things that realtors, bankers, insurance agents do all day long, which, if done by an attorney, take on an entirely different cast and an entirely different set of rules and an entire different set of protections. If you want to sell your house, you can go to a title company and have them handle it without a lawyer ever going near it. If I come to you and say, I will, as your representative, as your legal representative, represent you, I will do the title search, I will issue all of the documents, I will draft the documents, I'm performing those services as a lawyer, and you're entitled to a completely different set of protections. And that's the difference here. If you're in debt and you're sued by a creditor, you asked what we do differently. The debt settlement company that is not lawyers is going to tell you, gee, that's tough. Go hire a lawyer. We, at no additional fee, will do what can be done for that client at reasonable expense, and it's not just filling out forms. It's preparing responses to the legal pleadings. It's identifying defenses. We win cases all the time in court. It's responding to discovery. It's filing for discovery. Most of the people who are represented by debt settlement companies, when they are sued, don't even bother to go to court. They get judgments rendered against them without even being there. All you have to do is go down to the court in the morning and watch what happens. We are completely different and completely subject to a different set of rules. I might point out that the bankruptcy bar suffers from all of the same problems that Mr. Elwood has pointed out. In the last data available from the United States Trustee's Office for 2010, 86% of the people who were forced into Chapter 13s, and that's what the new credit law does, failed to get a discharge. Now they owe all the money back again, they've paid the trustees' fees, and they have a bankruptcy on their record. Okay. Yet that entire system is regulated by the bar, and all of the abuses which could arise in that circumstance are regulated by the federal courts and by the local courts here in the state. There is no reason to do anything else with respect to our practice, which is nothing more than a bankruptcy outside the protection of the court.
Thank you. Senator Letts, what is your pleasure on this? Would you like to take it to a judiciary? We're discussing the
no motion.
Yeah, no motion has been made at this point.
Well, Mr. Chairman,
Senator Letts,
I'm still torn because I'm recognizing merit in what Mr. Luther is saying and what Mr. Elwood is saying, and I wish to protect the consumers very strongly from those who are unscrupulously taking advantage of them. Yet I do know from personal experience that lawyers can add a value to a process, you know, that aren't available from non-lawyer companies in these situations. And I'm reluctant to sweep them in, at least not in the broad brush. I was wondering if there's some way that can be regulated without improperly infringing upon the fuller scope of legal services, unless there's some dispute as to what Mr. Luther's firm does, what the additional services are, and I'm not hearing that right now. So, I mean, at this point, I'm inclined to ask for a vote on my amendment. But I don't know, I'm feeling like there might be something more that needs to be done here before I'm completely comfortable with it.
Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Senator Latz's comments. And again, if Mr. Luther's firm is not engaged in unscrupulous activities, I don't think he has anything to worry about. Again, we are just trying to, again, have the same rules for everybody that's in the debt settlement and debt management, and that is really all this bill is trying to accomplish. Let's have everyone in the state of Minnesota in treating the folks that have been hurt by unscrupulous lawyers. Let's make sure everybody's playing by the same rules, and that's all. And that's as simple as I can boil it down.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. Senator Chairman. Lutz, would you? You said inclined. Are you ready to make a motion?
Well, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Metzen.
I think Senator Letts brings up some good thoughts here, and I think sometimes reasonable people can maybe reach hopefully some middle ground or something. So, and we're going to be around for another week here, I think. And I think, like I've always said around this committee, that this is where the decision should be made. So I would think we could probably lay this over just for more discussion. And if there's some middle ground, if not, then we'll take up Senator Dahl's and just vote it up or down. But let's I'll move to table it for at this time.
Senator Metzen's moved to table.
We could just lay it over without moving to table. Thanks, Mr. Chairman.
Lay it over. Is that
okay?
Senator Stang, is that a better?
If it's going to be laid over, Senator Jensen, did you have a comment?
Well, I wanted to say the comment prior to being laid over.
But there wasn't a motion, so we're just going to...
Well, my concern about this is obviously the intent of the bill when it was originally done to protect consumers when it comes to the settlement of debt. They were trying to incorporate and tackle this issue that we're tackling now way back then, and there were things that happened that indicated that that's not working. So I'm not sure how laying it over and deciding then that, oh, we need to look at it some more is going to come to any kind of conclusion. Because it was intended, right? Am I correct? It was intended originally to make sure that the consumer knew and had those protections available in any circumstance. And it just happens that attorneys participate in that as well. So there is a big gap between when an attorney firm decides that they're going to go into the debt management and help consumers with that portion versus a firm. And I'm not sure how continuing this conversation is going to come to any other conclusion other than we all want to protect consumers, and there's this middle gray area that we can't write legislation for, at least not to suit everybody. So I think this committee could come to some conclusion and say, what is it that we really want to do with this piece, with this legislation? Do we want to fix it in a way that consumers know that those protections are there for them, either whoever it is that they're going to, but still protecting attorneys that want to provide advice? And I know as an insurance agent, I enjoy that kind of protection to be able to advise my client. So I'm torn too. I'm willing to vote for this legislation just based on the fact of how the original intent of the law was to protect consumers that are faced with the difficult thing to deal with their debt management. And if you happen to be a lawyer or a firm that decides you're going to go into that and focus on that, then you should apply with the rules, with the legislation that we wrote as legislators of the state of Minnesota.
Senator Dahl, would you like to proceed with a vote on this bill? Is that your intent?
Yeah.
Would you like to lay it over as the author?
We'll
lay it
Chairman,
over.
Chairman, I'm willing to do what the authors.
Mr. Chair, we'll lay it over. Can be assured of getting it heard.
Yeah. Yes, yeah, we will guarantee that, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Dahl. The bill will be held. Will be laid over.
That's the only way to get out of it right now. It's
Monday. We will meet next Monday on the market rules bill. Do we have a location in the same room? In the same room. Thank you very much. Meeting adjourned.
Announce the next. When do we get?